You are listening to a sermon by Dr. Colin Godwin, recorded on Sunday, May 4th, 2014, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
This is the first of two messages I've been invited to speak here. And I'd like to lay the groundwork this week for next week as we think about Anabaptist mission. I'm a Baptist pastor with strong Anabaptist inclination, so this is a strong interest of mine. I'm a missionary. I've done teaching and church planting, and for years in Europe I quietly called myself an evangelist. So mission is something that's very close to my heart in practical ways as we share the life of Christ that we've experienced in word and deed around us. My message this morning will be dipping into a 16th century interpretation of Matthew chapter 28, Anabaptist style. As many of you know, there was a bewildering cast of characters in 16th century Anabaptism. I had somebody this week saying, I thought Hans Hut founded the Hutterites until there was another fellow named Jacob Hutter, and which one was it? I'm going to try to focus in on a few characters this morning, perhaps some of the most important ones, as they investigate what it means to be a community, to have a minority Christian witness, to have an alternative Christian witness in what they not just perceive but experience to be a very hostile world. This morning I'd like to address the challenge of how to be a Christian fellowship in the world but not of the world, expressing Christ-like values of love, peace, and justice in a world where the opposite seems to thrive. Matthew 28, in the last verses, can either seem like a well-worn text to use for this exploration, or it can even seem like an odd text because of how it has been used somewhat simplistically as a motivator for verbal proclamation of a rather individualistic evangelical gospel. Interestingly, it was, without a doubt, the most significant text of the early Anabaptists, not only as a basis for evangelism, but for community formation and for social justice. Somehow they managed to hold it all together in a way that has become both mysterious and elusive for 20th century evangelicals. Even those who voice their conscience, their Christian conscience, before a watching world, to use a phrase borrowed from John Howard Yoder. Following Christ in evangelistic proclamation and possibly to martyrdom was an important expression of Anabaptist personal discipleship. Alongside Matthew 28, which we read together, and Mark 16, the same passage in the Markan version, Anabaptist missioners were motivated by Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, which meant for them that no land should be without the preaching of the gospel. This was something they discovered several hundred years before German pietists laid the groundwork for the great century of Protestant missionary expansion in the 18th and 19th centuries. Their successes, growth, and failures were affected by the degree of persecution that they experienced in the different territories. And again, we had a reminder of that this morning. Some of you in your own families can trace the geographical movements which were due to persecution. But they also appear to have worked with a missionary strategy in mind. This organized expansion is demonstrated by such meetings as the Missionary Conference, or the Martyrs' Synod, as it later became known, in August 1527, with the Augsburg Church sending out more than 24 missionaries in the 2 weeks following the meeting. Persecution soon reached Germany and Austria, as it had Switzerland earlier, and all but two or three of the 60 Anabaptists present at this Martyrs' Synod were killed in an organized wave of persecution emanating from the religious authorities. In other cases, the evolution of Anabaptist missionary activity was much less organized, with people from outside the community stumbling upon meetings. A visit by someone to sell milk to an Anabaptist neighbor could easily turn an invitation to remain and listen to the Anabaptist preacher present. And the milk vendor might be surprised that the pious people present were not the revolutionaries or criminals that the authorities had made them out to be. In their rediscoveries of community practices like believers' baptism, church discipline, the Lord's Supper as a communal event, foot washing in some communities, and varieties of communal sharing, Anabaptist believers argued that they simply read the New Testament and took it seriously. Just as Jesus' disciples went out preaching the gospel in a hostile world in the first century, so Jesus' Anabaptist disciples communicated their evangelistic message to the fractured religious world of the 16th century. And so we too must communicate it today. Despite strong persecution, Anabaptist missionary discipleship was present in France, Switzerland, Holland, Belgium, Austria, Italy, Poland, and in all of modern Germany within a few decades after the birth of the movement. Where I was planting a churches in Belgium in the early part of the Anabaptist movement, Anabaptists were the second largest faith group after Catholics, but they were almost completely eliminated by the persecution in the following decades. Some of them actually, this is historical footnote, I was trained as a historian, so I can't resist. Some of those persecuted Anabaptists in Belgium fled to Amsterdam, where they got on a boat and traveled to an obscure place in the Americas and founded a settlement which eventually became New York. And as it turns out, if you look in the journals of that time, there are American governors complaining that they couldn't understand what was going on in the Anabaptist churches because they spoke French. And there are names of streets that speak to this day to that heritage of the origin of that community in Manhattan. Footnote finished. This morning I'd like to explore with you an important aspect of community formation, especially how it was perceived by the Anabaptist foremothers and forefathers of the 16th century. I will be speaking about the importance of believers' baptism. And by extension, the way in which church communities which share some common set of convictions around baptism, non-resistance, the Lord's Supper, and community service can have a shared and alternative community mission in today's world. First, I'll add a few more words about myself. I was not raised in a Christian home, but came to faith in Christ in a Baptist church in Summerland, British Columbia, as a teenager. After university studies in Guelph, Toronto, and Hamilton, I became a Baptist pastor and later left for 17 years of missionary service overseas with my wife, Karen, who hopes to be with us next week. We go to West Point Grey Baptist Church, and my kids are involved there in something there this morning. The writings of John Howard Yoder had influenced me in my youth, but it was the difficult experience of planting churches amidst the spiritual poverty in Belgium, and later teaching and serving the poor in the material poverty of Rwanda and Kenya, that drew me deeper into Anabaptism. I continue to look at God's Word and to historic Anabaptism to instruct me on how Christians can build both intentional community and live in an incarnational witness in the world today. For the Anabaptists, discipleship and mission all started with baptism. The point of entry not only onto a church list of members, but a formal declaration that the new believer chose to live differently according to the way of Christ. It's difficult to overemphasize the importance that the orders of Jesus' commands in Matthew 28 had for the Anabaptists. A stress on the right order of the text is repeated in almost every discussion regarding the central tenet of Anabaptism. The insistence on the proper order of preaching first, followed by conversion, and then baptism is reflected in Anabaptist writings across the different geographical groupings of the movement, represented by authors such as Hans Hut, Hans Schlaffer, Hans Denk, Menno Simons, Peter Riedemann, Melchior Hoffman, Dirk Phillips, Balthasar Hubmaier, and Pilgrim Marpeck. That's the most names that I'm going to string out in any sentence this morning, I promise you. They had made their stand on baptism, and they linked infant baptism to the immorality of the state churches because you couldn't tell who was supposed to be living for Christ and who wasn't. And they didn't see a connection between these people that grew up in the church and the way that they were living in the world, living in violence and immorality as they saw it. Menno Simons wrote in 1539, "We have here the Lord's commandment," about, he's speaking of Matthew 28, 18 to 20, "as to when according to the ordinance of God it shall be administered and received, namely, that the gospel must first be preached, and then those baptized who believe it, as Christ says." The same insistence on the correct order of preach, convert, baptize, instruct is found in Hutterite documents, such as their Confession of Faith from 1565, where we read, "The knowledge of God comes from hearing the word of the gospel. Therefore, we teach that baptism should not be for little children only, but for those who have heard the word, believed it, and have recognized God." Citing Mark 16:16 as well as Matthew 28:19 and John 20:20, Balthasar Hubmaier sums up succinctly the place of baptism in the order of faith and conversion. From these words, one understands clearly, and certainly, he writes, that this sending of the apostles consists of three points or commands: first, preaching; second, faith; third, baptism. Throughout the tract on the Christian baptism of believers from 1525, considered to be the first systematic exploration of Baptist or Anabaptist theology, Hubmaier repeatedly insists on the importance of the order of Christ's commands in this text. And to the present day, I think understanding the boundaries or hedges of the Christian community is fundamental to its ability to be both alternative and missional. Thinking again about baptism, membership, and community expectations is particularly helpful in our era where Christians with historic Anabaptist convictions can so easily be torn between an unthoughtful mechanical fundamentalism which stresses individual salvation so far as to forget the gathered church, and a socially engaged liberalism which lowers the boundaries of faith so far as for there to no longer be any need of the visible church at all. I have titled this message, "Becoming an Alternative Missional Community." The first step in that missional journey, I believe, for the church is to understand what your alternative is. What are you an alternative to? What your community is? Alternative to what? Different how? Based on what? And perhaps most importantly, going where? The 16th century Anabaptists answered these questions by forming a baptized, discipling community around those who believed. Following Mark 16:16, the Anabaptists had no place in their thinking for somebody who was converted, but wasn't baptized, in their view, wasn't a part of a community. Speaking of martyrs this morning, the Martyr's Mirror, that long compendium of all those in those first Anabaptist centuries who suffered, tells the story of the conversion of John Steyerts and his cousin Peter from Flanders. No Anabaptist preacher is named as having come to convince them of their need to repent. Rather, they came to Anabaptism on their own through the search of the Bible. The Martyr's Mirror writes, "And as they were very zealous for God and searched the Holy Scriptures, they soon perceived that the believing and regenerated, according to the doctrine of Christ, as a sign of having being buried to former sins and risen with Christ and walking in newness of life, had to receive Christian baptism in the water. They were drawn from their individual conversion into community. The goal of their conversion was not to increase their church attendance, to add lists, names on the list of church members, to give alms to the poor, or some other Christian practice. They had to be baptized into the alternative community. This was necessary, of course, because they were being persecuted. You had to make a clear stand about what you believed before the watching world. I have to say that the exclusive focus on baptism that I'm talking about today may make us a little uncomfortable, even as Mennonites, or for me as a Baptist. But there's no denying that for them, baptism was the anchor to their alternative community mission. Baptism was a necessary point of entry into a different kind of community. The Anabaptist missionary proclamation included a clear moral imperative to enter into a changed life. Learning what would necessarily take place in the brotherhood or the sisterhood, they kept pretty separate in those days. There was no Anabaptist mission without an alternative community. And there was no alternative community without a clear understanding of how you got into that community, what was expected of you. Mission is not a series of activities. It's not a curriculum. Mission is not an event. Mission is lived out as an expression of a group of lives transformed by Christ, a group of people who have decided that through hell or high water, they're going to live this journey together. It's interesting to note that with all the pressure in the 16th century to lower the criteria of discipleship, and by that I mean recant or die, that's pretty strong pressure. The Anabaptists did the opposite. They raised the standards of community. They raised them. Much as I've seen in places in Africa where through the pressures of tribe and culture and with Islam and some odd kinds of secularism, Christians are being told to lower the importance of their faith. Believers' baptism for them not only meant a decision to follow Christ and formally enter the community, it meant persecution from one's neighbors, from the state churches, and from former friends, much as joining a Christian church is viewed in many parts of the world today that are hostile to the Christian faith. A few weeks ago, I was at one of the beaches not far from here, on Easter morning, and we in our Baptist church here at West Point Grey, we baptized some new believers in the cold water. It was an exciting time. We had a little brass band on the beach, And they gave their testimonies, and we had the joy of seeing some young people who had gone away from faith and had been restored to believing by the youth ministry of the church, say yes to baptism. That's always a joy. It was also a joy to hear the testimony of a Chinese academic who'd come over here as a student and who had been journeying, I think he said, for some 5 or 10 years in his faith. He was surely a Christian, and he had hesitated on being being baptized, because when you were baptized, that's when you were really in. That's when he could know that when he went back after his studies here, he could encounter some problems. It reminded me, perhaps, of Africa. It reminded me of the 16th century. Taking a risk to say, I am part of this community. I believe what they believe. I'm willing to take some flack for it, or worse. Anabaptist discipleship grounded in baptism functioned as a way to define who they were and what they believed. Without some kind of understanding of why Christians are different, you know, there's no way a church can be an alternative missional community in the world. Missional communities today understand, like the Anabaptists, both how they are different and why they are different. They express a set of shared values and expectations, and strangely, we are learning that high expectations of Christian discipleship create not only strong Christian communities, but also attract those seekers who are somehow seeking a Christian alternative to help them to explain the whisper of heaven in their hearts. We cannot invite people in unless we know who we are and we live what we believe. So the prelude, the necessary preparation to Christian mission, is Christian community. You can't have mission without community. This has been a long discussion about baptism, community formation, from a 16th century perspective. How much of their example and model is applicable to Anabaptists today in Vancouver is a question for each fellowship to answer. I don't think we need to go overboard and be undiscerning about what's relevant today. But it seems clear to me that their community standards were what enabled them to be alternative in their generation. It is out of baptism and the community which it formed that Christian mission can be expressed. As they face their own world of violence and economic injustice, their rallying cry and mission was not first and foremost to create pacifists or generate radical generosity or any of the other distinctives of Anabaptist community. Although all of these did follow in due course, their invitation was to a missional community of discipleship. I want to switch from a historic lens looking at Matthew 28 to a little more contemporary one. And I want to leave you a few thoughts and then some questions about how alternative community can be missional. Bernhard Ott of the Bienenberg Theological Seminary in Switzerland helps us to put the Great Commission discourse into practice by suggesting the following applications to the text. He suggests that mission comes with power and worship. While it might be easy to skip from baptism to evangelism, the text engages us first and foremost as a worship event. That's what the disciples did before the risen Christ. They bowed down. They worshiped him. They said, Jesus is Lord. He has all power in heaven and earth. Anabaptist mission cannot skip from dogma to deeds from peace to proclamation without spending time at the feet of our risen Lord. Without him, our mission to all the earth makes no sense. Without the presence of his Spirit, we can be lost in the detail of ritual or activity. Secondly, mission involves proclamation and healing. The central goal of the commandment is to make disciples. Both the evangelical Lausanne movement and the ecumenical movement could correctly identify evangelism and personal commitment as the first step to discipleship. But I think this can be reductionary if we stop there. Christ invited his disciples to enter into God's kingdom, involving a change of heart, a change of values, a change of attitude towards the world. Another footnote, this time a pet peeve of mine. Since coming back to Canada in July, I hear and I read sometimes the expression, expanding God's kingdom. I don't find that particular expression anywhere in the New Testament. And especially in the context where it's given, it's often used to explain the territorial expansion of some kind of church or ministry. The words that Jesus uses are entering the kingdom. Like a little child, he says, the kingdom is here, now. Meaning God is working already. We don't have to generate some sort of militaristic strategy to expand the frontiers for God. I think that assumes too much about our own ability and too little about God's. God is there. He is around us in our working in the lives of our neighbors. We might not be selling, there might not be a milk peddler coming to our door, but we have opportunities all the time to speak and to live for Christ. A disciple is to follow his master, so we must act as instruments of healing in a broken world, just as Christ did. This is a spiritual and political mission. In our ethical mission, we must oppose the forces of darkness, both the individual demons that cripple people's lives or the social evils that degrade whole tribes, nations, and cultures. Thirdly, this text points to ethics and prayer. Anabaptist mission is profoundly ethical. We are to teach people to obey all that Jesus commanded. And so, in fact, in Matthew's Gospel, I don't know a more difficult text than this one. Matthew is recording, in effect, a commandment to say, everything I've said so far, you need to do it. This is pointing back to the Sermon on the Mount. This is pointing back to the Lord's Prayer. This is pointing back to the commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves. This is not telling us that all we need to do is to pray a simple prayer and we're in. It's done. It goes on. The mission is to obey all that Jesus commanded. It's profoundly ethical. It means praying and living out the Lord's Prayer. And as Ott says, the ultimate purpose of proclaiming and demonstrating the reign of Christ is the formation of a community, a visible social reality, a city on a mountain, a light for the world, and an alternative social order, which is good news for all nations. I've explored Matthew 28, 18 to 20, from a historic Anabaptist perspective this morning, especially looking at baptism as a point of entry into an alternative community, whose mission calls women and men to practice kingdom ways and kingdom witness in the world. I'd like to close by asking you three questions. 16th century Anabaptist placed believers' baptism as a high point of entry into their communities. What is your point of entry? Number two, they had high expectations of people who would join their communities. This is what made them alternative. How is your congregation, your fellowship, alternative? And three, their community life produced mission efforts that were both planned and unplanned. How is Point Grey Fellowship missional? May the Lord move in our hearts as we continue to explore and try to obey Him in word and deed.